welcome to the final segment of this three-part interview series with Amy Doles on the topic of DBT and substance abuse. In this final section, Amy further elaborates on the DBT themes of radical acceptance, validation, recovery, interfering behaviors, between-session support, diary cards, the chain analysis, and the ultimate dialectic of acceptance versus change. Amy also discusses the integration of DBT with other models, including motivational interviewing, the 12 steps, and even grief counseling. Finally, Amy introduces the three different mindsets associated with recovery: addict mind, clean mind, and clear mind. Something you said at the beginning of the interview, and I'm going to paraphrase you a little bit, is that DBT is kind of this strange hybrid between behaviorism and humanism. It brings both of those together.
Yes.
So on one hand, DBT is a behavioral model in that it's teaching all of these skills, and these skills are very behavioral. But then on the other hand, DBT is full of concepts such as, like you mentioned, values. And then there's also this meaning skill. There's also prayer as a skill. There's also, you know, this idea of radical acceptance. In other words, there's all of these philosophical and existential parts of DBT.
Right.
Because DBT is ultimately about building a life worth living. That's kind of the existential overlay. It's not just random skills just to get out of hell. Mm-hmm. It's random skills to get out of hell, one, but then also to build a life worth living. I really like how you're weaving together both of those concepts.
That's why, as we're starting to get into these more kind of abstract skill sets, like the concepts of acceptance and interpersonal effectiveness, you need to have the ability to stay regulated and to feel safe in the present moment. That's why we spend so much time on mindfulness and distress tolerance before we move into those other skills, because this stuff can be a little bit more ethereal. It can be a little bit more abstract, which is, I think, difficult also.
Yeah. One of those concepts that I just happened to mention is radical acceptance.
Yeah.
I would like to dive into that a little bit more, because I know that can be a really difficult concept for some of our clients. And especially with this population in mind, because there's so much they need to radically accept, including their own addiction and including how their addiction has affected both themselves and others. Where do you even start with that one? How do you teach radical acceptance to this population?
I have so many things to say about this. So,
well, please say them.
Right. Radical acceptance, it's a necessary stepping stone on the path towards healing and sustained recovery. I mean, the serenity prayer, right? It's a well-known prayer in the recovery community. It's the essence of radical acceptance. So for those of you out there listening who don't know what that is, it goes like this: grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that is, again, like I said, the essence of radical acceptance. Acceptance is a journey. It's a direction that we're flowing. Oftentimes, it's the last step of the grieving process, if we're thinking about the stages of grief. And letting go of an addictive behavior can very much feel like grief for a lot of people. I explain to my clients that anger, depression, denial, bargaining, all of those things can be common experiences in the recovery process. It's funny that you mentioned that this is a difficult skill, because as I was preparing for this interview, I'm thinking about what are some tough skills to teach. That is the number one skill that comes to mind for me. I think it's the most difficult DBT skill to teach, because the acceptance, it's asking somebody to accept things that have caused them pain. And that can be interpreted as invalidation of their experience and their suffering. Many of the clients that I've worked with have often been told that their addiction is a choice, their psychological suffering isn't real, their struggles are a result of a weak will or poor character or lack of discipline. When I, as a facilitator, as a therapist, am encouraging acceptance skills, it might feel like they're being told by somebody that they should just accept their lot in life, which sounds very similar to the invalidating messages that they've received, maybe. And this, it could result in an increase in hopelessness and worthlessness. I think our clients understand, they understand acceptance, they understand the importance of it, but many continue to struggle with it because it's still relatively abstract. There aren't these concrete steps to take. If we're thinking about a skill set in distress tolerance like self-soothe, those are really specific behavioral approaches to change or to coping. Or if we're thinking about Dear Man, it's do this step first and then this step and then this step. Radical acceptance doesn't really have that. but can feel frustrating to people. I was thinking about the things that clients typically want to try to radically accept. And these are the things that often come up in group that I think are important for a therapist to touch on. It's the loss of trust from others. That's a big theme that comes up. Not being able to fall back on substances for comfort or coping anymore. I think that it's important for me to remove the shame and to encourage my clients to remove the shame of using and villainizing the use because it did serve a purpose at some point. It causes a lot of damage, and we know that we're not endorsing that behavior at all. But there is a grieving process around trying to let that go. And so that requires radical acceptance. Not being able to sustain a healthy relationship with substances is along that line too. Maybe there's a loss of job, a loss of relationships, financial security, housing, custody of children, freedom if somebody was incarcerated. All these things radical acceptance can help with. I think there needs to be first an acknowledgement of the experience of the pain, and then a recognition that some things are out of our control. And then lastly, identification of ways that we can use skills to move forward, because acceptance is the key to moving out of our suffering. That's the key point here, that if you want to move forward, if you want to release this heavy load that you've been carrying around, acceptance is the key to that. And it could take a really long time. So we have to be patient.
I'm loving everything you're saying. Yeah. So something I explained to clients is, you're right, radical acceptance is really, really tough. Mm-hmm. But here's the deal, not radically accepting is even harder.
It's harder. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So pick the lesser of the two evils if that's how you have to look at it.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you radically accept something that's very difficult, well, now you're on the path to healing, right? Mm. If you radically accept pain, that doesn't mean you now have no pain, but you have a different kind of pain, a pain that's more manageable, a pain that's more bearable, and a pain that will transform itself into something positive, redemptive. Whereas if there's something difficult in your life and you cannot radically accept it, well, chances are that will just get even worse.
Yeah, exactly. And the word stuck keeps coming to my mind, right? That we're stuck in suffering when we're not focusing on trying to work towards acceptance to move forward.
Yep. It is a difficult concept to explain to clients. So I often do use this serenity prayer as well. Mm. Because like you mentioned, that's a prayer, that's a poem, however you want to say that, that's very well accepted and embraced in the substance abuse community. Most people recognize it. And therefore, you can use that to explain a DBT concept.
Right.
You can use language that they're familiar with, as opposed to maybe Marcia Linehan-specific jargon.
Right, exactly.
I also like what you said about personifying addiction. Previously, you mentioned you can personify emotions and then change your relationship to your emotions as if it's a person. Well, you can do the same thing with an addiction too.
Right.
Because a lot of times, the addiction was their best friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they do have to grieve that loss.
Right. That reminds me of an exercise that I often do with my staff when I'm training them in on working with this specific population. I have them write down answers to all these questions. And some of them include, what's your favorite comfort meal? Like when you're really just wanting to feel warm. And I'm up in Minnesota, so we all say like mashed potatoes or lasagna or something warm like that. And then I have them name their favorite thing to do when they're wanting to celebrate. And then who they go to or who they talk to when they're feeling down, or what one of their hobbies is, or what do you do when you're bored? There's a variety of answers to all these questions. With the folks that we work with, oftentimes the answer to that question or to all of those questions is the same thing. It's going back to that substance. And so what are we doing then as facilitators, as therapists? We're telling them, hey, take all of those things, your support network, your comfort, what you do when you're bored, what you do when you're celebrating. You need to put all of that in the trash and you don't have that anymore. That's a really tall order, and it's a really scary thing to not have that to fall back on. And I do that exercise with people because I want people to have empathy and compassion for what we're asking our clients to do. And that kind of goes back to the dialectical abstinence thing. Like, this is going to take time to fill in those gaps, fill in those holes where we're asking them to take away that substance.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't just say, okay, stop the substance, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Right? There has to be a replacement, because that, like you mentioned, that substance played lots of different roles and crucial roles, roles that we need. So each time that we remove the substance, there's now a void that needs to be replaced with some kind of DBT skill.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
And something else that you said that I absolutely loved, so I just want to re-highlight it here, is you basically conceptualized radical acceptance as a grieving process, because going back to Kubler-Ross, the stages of grief culminate in acceptance. And I feel so validated right now, because that is also exactly how I teach radical acceptance. Yeah. I use the serenity prayer, but I also use the stages of grief. Mm-hmm. And so when a client is struggling with radically accepting something, I don't just say, hey, you know, suck it up, you need to accept that and move on.
Right.
No, if they're stuck with something that they're just really struggling to accept, what I do is grief counseling.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's identify the denial. Let's figure out the anger or the bargaining or the depression that's getting in the way. And we work through that. Mm. And then the culmination is acceptance.
Right. Right.
Thanks for mentioning all that.
Yeah. And well put too, to put it all together. Now I want to just go through some grief counseling with my folks too, to make it more formalized like that. I think totally makes sense.
So another major DBT concept is obviously validation.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking of this population in particular, because their addictions have caused lots of hurt, lots of pain, lots of damage. Mm-hmm. And chances are they've been invalidated because of a lot of their behaviors.
Right.
So how do you teach validation? How do you show validation, and how do you teach validation to this population?
I'm so glad that you just made that little adjustment to how you asked that, because that's exactly right. It first starts with modeling. Validation is something that I try to model and encourage in the therapeutic environment at all times. And that's how people really learn. Many of the folks that I work with not only have genetic predispositions to addictive behaviors, but also have lacked the resources and modeling from caregivers to develop healthy coping skills. So first off, it's important to do that psychoeducation with clients, that vulnerabilities and invalidating environment is the perfect combination for the development of mental health issues and addiction. And the key to moving forward is balancing validation of one's experience with the acceptance for the need to change. So again, bringing in the idea of the dialectical balance, we're teaching about validation, but also knowing that this has to be balanced out with change talk. Otherwise, we'll get really stuck in that one place. And I want my clients to validate themselves by acknowledging that it's totally understandable to want to continue engaging in those behaviors, because this has worked for them. And it's, like I said before, it's even possibly protected them for a good chunk of time. So that's how validation can kind of play into this population specifically. But also, again, balancing it out with, this way of living is not working anymore. It's not aligned with their long-term goals. It's not aligned with their values. It's likely hurting them. But they know that, right? They get that information through other resources. People have been telling them it's not working. People have been telling them that they're hurting themselves, they're hurting other people. But when we skip that step of validation, we keep shame front and center, which can oftentimes be a trigger for future relapses. And so ironically, it's like one of those little carnival, like finger trap things, right? The more that you struggle, the more you're trying to fight what reality, or the more you're trying to fight what it actually is, and you're trying to get out, you're too focused on change talk, you're too focused on moving forward, you're going to get more stuck. We need to kind of lean into these painful emotions or these painful experiences to be able to release ourselves. In group, what this looks like, or when I'm facilitating, I first try to model the skill by providing validation to my clients. And that's the best way that they can learn, like I said. And then the kind of second stage of that is that I encourage the clients to provide validating feedback with each other. Practicing giving that to each other is really important. And my hope in that practice, in getting it from me, seeing me do it, getting it from each other, is that they eventually learn how to validate themselves. That's the most important thing. Some clients who struggle in group will say, why do I have to be spending all this time in group giving feedback to other people? And it's not about them. It's about me. I want to focus on my problems. And I'll tell them, like, we want to change that self-talk. The things that you would say to yourself can be so invalidating, can be so harsh, and you would likely never say that to somebody else. And so the more you practice using that voice of validation, of acknowledgement with others, which is easier, then we can adopt that with ourselves. It's like a muscle that they're working out.
What you just said about self-validation reminds me of the cheerleading skill in DBT. Mm-hmm. I like to think of cheerleading as learning to self-validate.
Nice, yeah.
Because our clients are never going to get enough external validation that they need, especially in a crisis moment.
Right.
And therefore, at some point, they're going to have to learn to be their own self-validators. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that.
The beauty of that is their cup can always be filled up by themselves. They don't have to look to other people for acknowledgement of their existence, because that's really hard. You know, if you're surviving off of scraps from others, it's going to feel really unstable and anxiety provoking. But if you're the one that can give yourself that sort of strength, it's abundant. You can give it to yourself at all times. So it's actually kind of an empowering message as well.
Yeah, I really like that. Because if you were completely dependent on external validation, well, maybe you'll get it or maybe you won't.
Right.
Regardless, your life kind of hinges on what other people do or don't do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like you mentioned, self-validation is self-replenishing. It's always accessible.
Right.
Are there any particular treatment interfering behaviors that you encounter with this population that are problematic? And if so, how do you address those challenges?
The primary way we address treatment interfering behaviors is through the behavior chain analysis. And the most common one, unsurprisingly, is a slip or a relapse. That's something that we dig into. It's a requirement for the folks that I work with that if there's any sort of what we call a recovery interfering behavior or any other treatment interfering behavior, they have to prepare a behavior chain analysis. There has to be this written homework that is presented to the group. And it's not meant to be in like a shaming or punitive way. It really is for us to stretch out the decision-making process, figure out what can we learn from this? How can we learn from this? I'll tell my client, pretend like this is a laboratory and we're doing all these different experiments. And if the experiment goes awry, you don't just say, well, that sucked and I guess I'm never going to try that again. No, you go back and you analyze the data and you look at what could I tweak here? What could be different there? And you learn from it. And oftentimes that's how we get to big biological or technological advances, right? We move forward and there's a lot of progress when we make mistakes. So that's the first thing. We're taking this non-judgmental and neutral approach to treatment interfering behaviors, and we're just trying to learn. This behavior chain analysis document has been slightly modified for this population, for the needs of this population. We will ask about the typical things like vulnerabilities, triggers, urges, and actions, but we'll also incorporate relapse prevention. So it's really important for our clients to be able to start planning for the future, since we know that an experience of a slip or a relapse can be the catalyst for continued use. And I'll have my clients specifically identify how they will remove their access to substances, so the bridge burning skill, who they're going to reach out to for sober support. So that could be attending to relationships. And then skills that they will use at various levels of urge intensity. So we know that maybe the push away skill or distraction skill might work when you have a lower level urge, but when you're at a 9 out of 10, maybe you need to call for help. So there are different skills you need to use at different levels of intensity. And lastly, I really want my clients to think in the future, how will they celebrate their success? How will they feel when they're able to put a no on their diary card that they didn't act on the urge to use? I want them to start to go through that rehearsal in their minds and start to live that out and imagine what that might feel like to start almost building the neural pathway of success. Because I think that just as important as the engaging in the healthy behavior, it's important to reflect on the good choices we've made to solidify that pathway.
Sure. DBT also has this concept of providing between session support. Is that something you do as a clinician?
Yeah, we offer brief phone coaching during office hours. And then I also always encourage my clients to connect with peer recovery support. So like a sponsor through a recovery support program or a certified peer support specialist. They can get it through the county services too. But also the way that we really want our clients to stay connected with DBT is through the daily engagement with the diary card and with the skills. And so it's a really common kind of, I don't want to say mistake, but it's something that people struggle with often in DBT is doing that diary card homework every day. And this is exactly why I stress the importance of it. I say you have to think about the skills when you're not here. And that's how you're going to stay connected with DBT. Our program is moving a little bit away from the adherent Marshall Linehan model in that we don't have that 24-hour coaching line, but we do see each other more often. It's an intensive outpatient. So instead of one day a week, we have 3 days a week plus individual therapy, and then office hours were available.
A little bit earlier, you mentioned that radical acceptance is the most difficult skill for you to teach this population. Do you find that there's any other DBT skills that are challenging? Or is that the main one?
Well, that's kind of the main one. I do think, you know, Dear Man is interesting because it is more concrete. It's something that clients are excited to learn about because they want to know how to be more assertive and how to set boundaries. But I find that the difficulty in that skill is that it's often misunderstood. The Dear Man skills, we label it as this is how you can learn to be assertive, communicate effectively. Oftentimes, clients see it as this is the way that I'm going to get what I want, or this is how I'm going to advocate for myself without thinking about the other person. I bring up this kind of funny example that I had in group a long time ago. Somebody said, okay, Susan, I want to do a Dear Man on you. I just think that you're so awful and I just needed to say that. And I was like, okay, that's not a Dear Man. Like, you're saying how you feel. And I think there's this misconception that being aggressive or assertive in that way means that you're using Dear Man. To kind of offset that, I will make sure that when I'm teaching that skill, I'll tell clients, this is about improving the relationship quality. This is about clear communication. This is about practicing being direct in how you feel and also processing this a little bit before you do it, maybe writing it out, maybe talking to somebody about what you want to say with this Dear Man so that you are thinking about solutions. And so instead of, with that example in group, instead of, oh, you're just such an awful person, I can't stand being around you, they skipped the step of, first of all, what are you feeling? What are the actual objective facts? And how do you want to improve this relationship through communicating clearly? And so I think Dear Man takes a lot of clarification. That's kind of the one that comes to mind for me.
I've also faced some of those same challenges with Dear Man. Mm-hmm. And so in fact, I've kind of made a modification to that. I call it Dear Adult for several different reasons. And I use the same acronym of Dear, but I expand it a little bit more just for the reasons you've mentioned. Mm. So the D is, I still use it as describe, but for E, it's not just express, it's also empathize. So yes, express how you feel, but empathize with how the other person feels, right?
It
needs to be
that.
This two-way street. And then for A, yes, it's, I still use the A for assert, but I also use it for appreciate the other person's perspective. Don't just assert what you want and need. Mm. And then I also use the A for apologize if necessary.
Right, right.
And then for reinforce, the point I try to drive home with reinforce, this isn't just about reinforcing your request. It's really about reinforcing, like you mentioned, the quality of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to start using that. Thank you.
Please do. It's interesting to me that you mentioned Dear Man and radical acceptance as the two most challenging skills to teach clients. And just to follow up on a point you made earlier, you mentioned how Dear Man, it's very concrete and sequential, right? Do this, then that, then that. Yeah. Whereas radical acceptance is just kind of more nebulous, more abstract, more theoretical. So I want to go back to a point that you made, and that is you kind of use grief counseling. And I really like that because grief counseling does provide the steps.
Right, right.
So it does kind of make radical acceptance a little more concrete and tangible for our clients.
Exactly.
We're going to work through some denial, and then we'll work through some anger, and then we'll work through some bargaining, right? I can tell throughout this entire interview so far that even though we've never communicated before, we are on the same page.
I know. That's so wonderful. DBT bringing people together.
Yeah. You've mentioned already some adaptations you've made to DBT. For example, you don't literally do 24/7 phone access, which I don't do either.
Right.
Are there other adaptations you've made to standard DBT specifically for this population?
Yeah, maybe I mentioned this before, that we see each other more often. So this is an intensive outpatient level of care for DBT, which where I'm at, it's sort of unique in a sense, because most DBT programs are one day a week. And so we've noticed that there was a need in the population for folks who have more severe suicidality and more severe depression and anxiety symptoms that really need to be out of the house and into programming and connecting with people more often. That's something that's sort of unique to our programming as well. Specific to this population, there are some additional skills that we teach on. I mentioned dialectical abstinence. That's something we cover in group. There's something called the addiction states of mind. There's addict mind, which is all the behaviors and thoughts and feelings associated with addiction. There's clean mind, which is kind of the pink cloud or not really oversimplifying recovery. And then the last stage is clear mind, which is understanding the risks for relapse, but also being excited about recovery and really fully engaging in it. So the addiction states of mind is new. We'll talk about processing resentments and making amends also in interpersonal effectiveness, again, aligning with the 12 steps in that way. Also, when people come into our programming, we require a chemical health screening to be completed before being placed. And in addition to gathering background information about their use, we also spend some time talking about their motivation to change and motivation to participate fully in this program as well. We have some other kind of homeworky stuff. There's this substance use behavior prevention plan that we have. We have the adapted diary card that I talked about where people are reporting on intensity of urges, recovery interfering behaviors, and sober supports and things like that.
Just a moment ago, you mentioned the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. And then you also mentioned motivation. You didn't use the term motivational interviewing per se. Those are two approaches that I integrate with DBT when I'm treating this population. Are you integrating other models as well?
Yes. Motivational interviewing is the number one model that I encourage my trainees and students to learn about. This is so important to know about when working with this population. I use motivational interviewing when working with ambivalent clients, responding to and normalizing resistance, listening to clients' needs and goals, and making the treatment planning process collaborative. So I really feel like the preparation to work with this population is not complete until you know about motivational interviewing. I also am kind of a geek about, I just really enjoy it. I have a four-year-old at home, and so I'm using a lot of tactics with him. My husband read a book that was written by a FBI negotiator, and he is like, I think we can use this on our son. I think this is going to be really helpful. And it's all tactics. Yeah, so
no, I totally agree.
Yeah. I mentioned the 12 steps, and we bring in those as well, just to have the language be familiar for our clients. But another model that we integrate into DBT are the stages of change. We use DBT skills to increase awareness of an individual's motivation to change, and then we want to move forward and engage in the change process. So I will actually do a whole teaching on the stages of change when I'm in group.
I do all of that too. So nice. DBT has this main dialectic of acceptance and change, but it's kind of just left as this ideal. How do you actually conceptualize and balance those two? DBT doesn't really give you the nuts and bolts of that. I operationalize the acceptance with the stages of grief that we talked about, because that lays out the stages of acceptance. And then I use the stages of change for motivational interviewing to conceptualize change. Mm-hmm. And now I have something concrete to figure out. So where is a client at with acceptance or change on any given issue?
Right.
And then I use motivational interviewing to work them through that. How do you balance acceptance and change? Well, I use motivational interviewing to do that. In my opinion, motivational interviewing is the synthesis of acceptance and change.
Yes, precisely. Yep.
How do you change someone by accepting where they're at and accepting what motivates them?
Mm-hmm. I just love the theme of self-sufficiency and empowerment in motivational interviewing, that you're putting the onus on the client. And that really is woven into the philosophical approach that we take here at our clinic, that the client is, they're the expert on themselves, and they need to be the lead of their treatment team, really. I think that that sometimes is a unique experience for the client who, that we're serving, because maybe they've been filtered through a lot of different programs where they're treated like a prisoner, or they're treated like somebody who's done all these bad things, and they're over-pathologized as well. So we really want to break down that experience by saying, okay, you are in charge here. You're in the lead. I'm here to guide you and kind of reflect on the hierarchy of need and things that are important here. But also, ultimately, they're the ones that are creating their path forward, and they need to tell us about that.
Sure. The other reason I really like integrating the 12 steps is because the 12 steps are loaded with DBT concepts.
Right.
But they're in language that's more accessible to our clients. Mm-hmm. So throughout the 12 steps, you will see the themes of willingness, and you'll see the themes of radical acceptance, and you'll see the themes of mindfulness, and you'll see the themes of interpersonal effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of operationalized in language that our clients already understand.
Right.
Amy, this has been such a pleasure. I've learned so much from you.
Likewise.
So as we
Thank
kind
you.
Of wind down and wrap up here, I just want to ask you one final question, if that's okay.
Of course.
And that is, what are your own favorite DBT skills that you use in your own personal life?
I love this question because I do have one favorite skill, and it's BPE. It's building positive experiences, and specifically mindfully building positive experiences. I love this because I'm a fun-loving person and I just want to experience all that I can. And it also is really empowering to know that if I want to feel good feelings, really, I just need to tune into my environment. And the way that I practice this skill most often is in nature and with my family. And these two things, I've chosen them purposefully because they're free and they're abundant. It just makes me feel more connected to my surroundings. I feel more balanced. I feel more grounded when I'm connecting to positive experiences. I love teaching on that skill because I have my clients list out all the things that make them happy. Oftentimes there are things like a new pair of socks or clean sheets, these really simple things that we forget about. And I have them then read it to each other and we're all kind of giggling and smiling. And I'm like, look, nothing like happened here today, but we're just talking about these things that we like. And look at how our mood has changed. That's a super fun skill for me to practice and also teach.
That's great.
Yeah.
Amy, I wish we could keep talking the rest of the day, but I fear we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. And I sincerely hope our paths will continue to cross.
I agree. Thank you so much for having me.
There are three main points from this section. First, it is helpful to conceptualize an addiction as an unhealthy relationship, the same way it is possible to develop an unhealthy dependence on a real person. Since giving up an addiction is like losing a relationship or even a best friend, grief counseling is sometimes necessary to help clients work towards a state of radical acceptance. DBT is also highly compatible with other forms of recovery, such as motivational interviewing and the 12 steps. Second, learning to manage recovery interfering behaviors is the DBT version of relapse prevention, which is a critical aspect of substance abuse treatment. The following DBT interventions assist with relapse prevention: diary cards, between session support, and chain analyses, which help clients identify the vulnerabilities, triggers, urges, and behaviors which lead to relapse. And third, DBT has three mindsets related to recovery: addict mind, clean mind, and clear mind. Addict mind is actively engaged in the addictive behavior and is not concerned with recovery, abstinence, or sobriety. Clean mind recognizes the need for physical sobriety, but then erroneously assumes that maintaining sobriety will be an effortless process. Therefore, clean mind fails to acknowledge and prepare for triggers which could result in relapse. Clear mind is the synthesis of the other two minds. Clear mind recognizes the need for maintaining sobriety while simultaneously recognizing the ongoing addictive tendencies, urges, and triggers, which could potentially result in relapse.